From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, Super Soldiers. But here's what's happening. The United States has carried out an airstrike near Baghdad at the beginning of the intensified action against the ISIS militants in Iraq. U.S. attack aircraft hit an ISIS fighting position southwest of the capital in support of the Iraqi security forces, and they will continue to do so. The Syrian military's air defenses could face retaliation if Syria attempts to respond to any U.S. airstrikes that are expected against Islamic State targets in Syria as well. President Barack Obama's authorization of the use of American air power against Islamic State's strongholds in Syria has raised the question of whether Syrian President Assad would respond in some way. If he's smart, he won't. In a moment, William Forston joins us with his thoughts on this entire situation. The Federal Bureau of Investigation's Next Generation Identification System. It's a biometric database reliant on tens of millions of facial recognition records, is now fully operational. The system, after 3 years of development, is billed by the FBI as a new breakthrough for criminal identification and data sharing between law enforcement and agencies. The database contains over 100 million individual records that link a person's fingerprints, palm prints, iris scans, facial recognition data with several information like their home address, age, legal status, and other compromising details. Perhaps the most controversial aspect is the facial recognition information, which civil liberties advocates have said for years is among the most serious future threats to American privacy. The database is expected to contain, get this, 52 million facial recognition images alone by 2015. A new Missouri law banning schools from electronically tracking students is part of a recent national push among states to increase privacy protections. We're actually winning a few battles here. The bill would take effect in October after lawmakers overrode Governor Jay Nixon's veto of the bill this past week, just barely getting the required two-thirds majority, by the way. The ban joins growing pushback and legislative efforts in other states aimed at protecting electronic privacy. Privacy expert Catherine Albrecht with us. This is a victory, Catherine.
Hey, George, it's about time we see one of these.
I
was in all the way back in 2006. We thought we had a sure victory in the state of California when the California State Senate and House passed, or Assembly, overwhelmingly passed the same bill, basically banning RFID in schools. Nearly 10 years ago, Arnold Schwarzenegger came along, completely vetoed it. He terminated our bill. And we've now seen bills introduced in several other states, including Oregon and Texas. None of them have managed to pull it off. Missouri pulled it off earlier this year. Then Governor Jay Nixon came along in July, vetoed the bill, wrote in his veto letter that he thinks that schools will probably want to use this technology, and so why would you ban it? And the lawmakers of the state of Missouri, the show me state, said, maybe you're trying to show me a little too much.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get some privacy back here. And they overrode the veto, so it's going to be illegal as of October to RFID chip school kids.
Super.
In Missouri.
And what do you think of this FBI's facial recognition system?
It's really creepy, but I got to tell you, all they've got to do is tap into all of the trillions of photographs that people have uploaded onto the internet, literally billions uploaded onto Facebook alone. We've got to be a little bit more thoughtful about where we put our pictures, because your face is one thing you really can't hide. You know, you can put
right.
your password in your pocket, but your face is out there for everyone to see.
Catherine, give us a few of your websites.
Hey, I've got a couple of them. I do a daily radio show at my name, CatherineAlbrecht.com or KMAshow.com. Start Mail is, we've now issued the first paid Start Mail accounts. We're super excited. StartMail.com, private email, and of course, Start Page, the world's most private search engine.
You got it. Catherine, thanks so much. Got to do a big show with you one day. Apple has sold a record 4 million iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus smartphones the first day that those new iGadgets were available for pre-order. Demand for the new iPhones was so high that the iPhone 6 sold out within hours. While many people who pre-ordered the iPhone 6 will get them this Friday, many others won't get their iPhones delivered until next month. Great for sales for Apple. Indiana and Montana have now joined the growing list of states with confirmed cases of the enterovirus D68. Now four children in Lake County were sickened by the virus, treated at the University of Chicago Hospital, according to a press release from the Indiana Department of Health. All four have since been discharged from the hospital. Montana has one confirmed case. This virus is common, especially in the fall and winter months. 10 to 15 million infections occur in the United States each year. This one, though, is tough. Children are having problems with breathing with this virus. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warning hospitals and doctors that now is the time to prepare. They've issued a 6-page Ebola checklist to help healthcare workers quickly determine if patients are infected. Now, while the CDC does not believe that there are any new cases of Ebola in the United States, the assumption in the checklist is that only a matter of time before the virus hits home. Let's check in with Gary Ridenour, the expert on pandemics. Gary, what do they know that they haven't told us?
What they know is that each human that is infected produces 23 billion viruses a day. And when you're producing that many viruses in your body, sooner or later there's going to be a mutation, and we're going to get an airborne form of this Ebola, and we're off to the races.
Well, now, in this particular case, they're working on this checklist, getting it to special hospitals, and some of them include, you know, isolation, quarantine, get your supplies ready, make policy. To me, it sounds like they really expect something.
Yeah, I think they do, this is like a slow lava flow. It just keeps moving and burning everything and moving and burning, and you can't stop it. The explosion is coming soon from this.
All right, Gary, we'll check in with you, too, future stories as well. Now, imagine this horror story. You're a parent. You have a child that has special needs. The child rarely speaks, can't cry out for help. You wake up in the morning and find out that the little 3-year-old, your child, has been chomped on by a rat. And the little kid couldn't cry. You had no idea what was going on. That's what happened in Brooklyn. A mother says that she and her 3-year-old son are still traumatized after she found the boy covered in bite marks and blood in his bed from what she believes to be a rat attack. The boy had open wounds across his face, neck, feet. The mother believes he was bitten by a rat or several rats while he slept. Why aren't they doing anything about that? In Boyers, Pennsylvania, by the way, a recently opened 2,000-square-foot data center has been built to protect against an electromagnetic pulse generated by a solar storm or a nuclear event. They want to save the data. That's one of the first where somebody's beginning to think about the dangers of an EMP attack or a solar flare. In a moment, William Forstchen, of course, who wrote the book 1 Second After, who's championed with me to get the power grid insulated, has now written a new book called Day of Wrath, a time-sensitive warning to protect our schools and transportation systems from the threat of an attack by ISIS. Both timely subjects, and we'll talk with William about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. William Forstchen with us tonight for a few hours, PhD from Purdue University, specializing in military history and the history of technology. He, of course, is with me all the way. One of the reasons I jumped on board with William and with Michael Maloof to try to get the grid insulated. William's book is 1 Second After. We'll also talk about his latest, Day of Wrath. William, welcome back.
George, it's a pleasure to be with you, and we got through the weekend okay.
Yeah, we did. A couple more flares, but one day, if they don't do what we've been telling them to do, we're in trouble. Hey, what's your reaction to this center opening up this 2,000-square-foot data center?
I think it's the tip of the iceberg. I've never had a security clearance, of course, and that's one of the reasons we can talk so openly, but data centers are being built. Now, what's that megaplex out in, what is it, Utah that the government's put up?
Mm-hmm. Huge.
I would assume all that is well secured against EMP and CME.
But we're not.
We're not. I remember doing an interview several years back where the interviewer was a bit skeptical about the end. He said, wait a minute. What happens to my mortgage? What happens to my credit card bills? What happens to my alimony payments? If it all gets wiped out, maybe we should just bring it on.
Yeah, but they'll have those stored in these data centers.
Yes, yes. So you will continue to pay your mortgage a month afterwards if you still have money that works.
I've got to tell you, though, Bill, since you and I and Michael Maloof have started to really talk about this and push it, and you and I have been talking about this for years now, lately it appears to me that the mainstream media is beginning to talk about it. Are you sensing that too? Even though they're late, they're at least starting to talk about it.
Something I found really ironic was, it was about 4 or 6 weeks ago, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times started talking about the Fresno incident of April a year ago, and I'll leave it to you to elaborate. You and I were on air, it was about a week after that, discussing it. But it took a year and a half for mainstream media to catch up to it. You were on top of it from the beginning.
This was a flare that almost could have been a Carrington-type event, which was that huge flare in the 1800s that knocked out the telegraph system. But it was coming off the side of the sun. It wasn't facing us directly. Had it done that, we probably wouldn't be talking right now. We'd be off the air.
Yeah, it was. If the Earth had been 5 days further back in its rotational period around the sun, we would have caught that square on, a Carrington-level event named after an astronomer who first observed this massive solar flare in 1859. We never would have made it onto the air. Or the incident with the terrorist scenario where they blew out the transformers in Fresno. In both cases, you were on top of it first, and it wasn't until just now that both of those incidents have come up in the news within the last couple of months.
And over the last couple of days, the sun has kicked off a couple more smaller X flares with warnings going up and down.
Yeah. The event over the weekend, it was a double whammy, which is the really scary scenario. The first CME, coronal mass ejection, you got about maybe up to 12, 24 hours warning time because it travels slower than the speed of light. That first one hits our magnetosphere, gets things shaken up. It's almost like drilling a hole through a dam. And then the second one came slamming in on Friday and Saturday night, and it went up to a G3 level, which we have not seen in years. Just like you got tornadoes and hurricanes rated like 1 to 5, G3 is pretty darn serious. G4... and the power grid in the northern United States would have gone down.
Oh, that's
the further north you go, the more vulnerable we are to a CME.
Well, your book, One Second After, is one of the Bibles of talking about EMPs and solar flares. But your latest is written in a novel form, and it's just as scary. It's called Day of Wrath. It has to do with ISIS. And I want you to tell us how you got involved with this, Bill.
That was about the toughest 6 weeks of my life as a writer. I had just finished up writing the sequel, The One Second After, which will come out next year. I turned to now my fiance, Robin, and we were talking about, gee, we're going to have the summer off. And the conversation on that day, June 28th, turned to a twin issue, ISIS overrunning most of northern Iraq, and an offensive that we have not seen that level of territory taken since the German offenses of World War II. Concurrent with that was all the reports of the collapse of security on the southern border. A good friend of mine and Robin both urged me, Bill, you got to write something about it. George, it was about the worst 6 weeks of my life as a writer, researching behind and looking in at what ISIS is really doing, and then turning it into a short novel in the same style I did with One Second After, of this is how ISIS is going to do us. My scenario is they're going to go for the soft targets in America.
You know, a lot of people are saying, William, okay, this is a false flag again. This is government making this up just so they can get involved militarily again in the Middle East. Here we go. This is a tough call because on one hand, you know, you've got this lunatic beheading journalists and you've got ISIS killing Christians. I know this for a fact. And doing what they're doing, creating mayhem in the Middle East. And, of course, we've got to protect our oil interests there as well. It's real. It's ongoing. It's real. Why do people think this is a false flag?
That is, I mean, you and I both deal with conspiracy theorists all the time. There's times where we would say, yeah, okay. There's other times it's like, what planet are you from?
Right. You got to be careful.
You got to be careful. Let's roll the clock back about 4 months when ISIS suddenly came springing out of eastern Syria. They overran a good quarter of the country of Iraq within a matter of several weeks. Now, the Kurds, who are a separate group up in that northeast corner of Iraq, they effectively stood against Saddam Hussein. They effectively stood prior to that against the Ottoman Empire. They lost half their territory within about 2 weeks. The Kurds are some of the toughest fighters in the world. Recall that in 93, I believe it was, we established a no-fly zone to protect the Kurdish region in northern Iraq. We left them out there hanging. They got overrun. In June, ISIS was already using social media, pushing out their message. I looked at stuff, some of it, frankly, I'm not going to talk about it on the air, but you know, you've undoubtedly looked at it too, of women being crucified.
Yes, it's
with these Sharia law lunatics laughing at them, children being beheaded, the execution of POWs. I assume, George, you might have seen what they call the River of Blood, where they executed 1,500 POWs that they took from the Iraqi army, and they were dumping them into the river and standing there laughing because the river had turned red.
Oh, they're butchers. They're absolute butchers. So
there's like,
you know, a lot of Arab nations and many other nations have joined with us now to try to stop this. But why did it take so long? These people have been out there for a long time. They've been financed by, I would guess, some pretty rich folks in the Middle East.
Oh, yeah. Yes. For example, the whole issue with Hamas and Israel, where did the money really come from? Qatar, Q-A-T-A-R, which was pumping billions of dollars into Hamas to attack Israel. And during that war of last month, where were the Hamas leadership? They were sitting in high-class hotels in Qatar, partying it up. So the same thing with ISIS. ISIS was getting underground funding. And my great concern is everything that ISIS has promised they would do, they've done.
I mean, you don't even hear the word Al-Qaeda anymore.
Oh, Al-Qaeda is our grandparents' terrorist group. That's old-fashioned terrorism. They hold Al-Qaeda in contempt. And it's like, you know the photos that you see in space of a black hole sucking material out of a nearby sun? Well, picture that dying sun as Al-Qaeda and this new black hole sucking in tens of thousands. Most recent CIA estimate, unclassified, is they've grown from 5,000 fighters to 31,000 fighters within the last 3 to 4 months. They hold Al-Qaeda in contempt.
And they're well-trained.
They're terrifyingly well-trained. And thousands of Europeans and hundreds of Americans have gone over and joined them as well. Now, they're the really terrifying aspect of it. They are acculturated. They understand Western culture. They can blend in easily. They're killers for ISIS. They're already coming back west to set us up.
Well, see, I am wondering, and we'll get into your book, The Day of Wrath, in a moment here after we come back from the break, but I am wondering at what point do they try to fight back, not in the Middle East, but here?
ISIS promised 1 month will be in Europe, 2 months will be in America. They made that promise several weeks ago.
It doesn't take a lot of people to create mayhem.
19.
Look what that
9/11.
Look what they did. All right, stay with us. William Forstchen, we will talk about his work, Day of Wrath. Here is the subtitle, so you can get a better perspective of what we're talking about here. A time-sensitive warning to protect our schools and transportation systems from the threat of an attack by ISIS. William, when you put this together, did it scare you?
Did it scare me? My fiance is in the same room. I could almost put her on the phone And you ask her the question of how many midnight and 2 a.m. phone calls she got from me while I was working on it. I'll unashamedly admit, I was in tears. I was saying, my God, I can't work on this anymore.
All right.
I just watched a video.
We're going to get right into it, William, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you haven't liked us yet on Facebook, please do so by going to our website, coasttocoastam.com or georgenorrie.com. Up in the far right-hand corner, you'll see the little Facebook icon. Click that, because we're approaching a milestone unheard of here with the show, and we want you to participate in that. So go ahead and do that. If you're not liking us yet on Facebook, that doesn't sound right, does it? But go ahead and do that. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. William Forstchen with us, Day of Wrath. It's a fictional book. Why do you write a fictional book about something that is truly real, William?
I get hit with that a lot. I mean, One Second After was a fictional work, but I remember years ago when I started working on One Second After, and I was talking with Congressman Roscoe Bartlett, who both you and I think The Sun Rises and Sets on, and wishes he was still in there, and he urged me on with it, saying, you have to popularize the subject to get people interested. You know, I'm a history teacher. I've been a professor for 20 years. I find a lot of times a good fictional work will get my students interested. Then I can say, okay, now that you've read that, why don't you read the real stuff? So if I can reach people through popular culture, get them involved in the issue, and then move on. The great example is the book I did on EMP, and look at several of the great works that have come out now that are hardcore, this is how it really works. So popular culture is a way of reaching people. So I fictionalize an account of ISIS attacking the United States and Day of Wrath.
Nothing frightens a parent more than the possibility of their child being injured. And nothing frightens them more to know that it's happening in a school and they're helpless, the child and the parent. In 2004, in Chechnya, terrorists seized a school there. There were more than 300 deaths, maybe more. You think that could happen here?
Yeah, you just hit it square on. That's where I drew from to write the book Day of Wrath. What you described is in 2004, on the first day of school, September 1st, 2004, Islamic terrorists seized a school in the town of Beslan, which is in up near the Caucasus. They held it for 3 days. According to the Russian government, 334 people died. Estimates are it's actually around 500 to 600. I don't even want to say on the air what they were doing to 10-year-old girls on the roof of the building. When they finally cut their throats, it was a mercy to incite the media and incite the community. We in America, when we think about the horror of school shootings, which we all are terrified of, let's look at Newtown. 22 children died in that school on that terrible day. But that's the profile of how lone shooters in America have worked. Come in, empty out one or two magazines, commit suicide.
Yeah.
Now let's look at the Beslan scenario. Imagine 3 to 5 trained terrorists walking into a school. The "this is a no-gun zone" sign is not going to stop them.
Not going to stop them at all. And these are, you know, heavily loaded terrorists.
Yes. At Newtown that day, while we were watching a gut-wrenching tragedy of them taking little bodies out, recall that 300 to 400 children escaped alive, traumatized for life, but escaped alive. Now, 3 to 5 terrorists, you have 300 to 400 children dead in a school within 15 to 30 minutes. That's what we're facing at this very moment.
How easy is it for them to get into the country, get their weapons, do what they have to do?
They're already here. When part of the trigger for writing Day of Wrath is a good friend of mine, a writer, New York Times bestselling author in his own right, Webb Griffin Jr., we were talking. He was living in Texas, and he has a lot of friends with border security and other law enforcement agencies. They were telling him, look, you know, we're focusing on Brownsville. However we feel about the immigration issue, we're focusing on that with 10,000 children showing up. Go 50 miles away from Brownsville. The border is wide open. I was just talking this evening with a friend of mine who said there's a vast area of New Mexico that's been declared a wildlife preserve area that law enforcement can no longer go into. Who's in that wildlife preserve area in New Mexico? And I hope one of your listeners from that region calls in. They're already inside. ISIS has direct contact, this again, all public information, with the Mexican drug cartels. They're not doing it to buy drugs. They're experts, the cartel is experts at smuggling.
Yes.
Why would ISIS be communicating with them?
Hundreds, you believe, could be in the country already. What are they waiting for?
Waiting for the signal, coordinated attack.
One location, multiple locations?
The scenario I paint in Day of Wrath is they would hit multiple locations, very low tech. Consider, after 9/11, do you think anybody could actually seize an American plane today?
No, it probably could not happen. Now, I mean, I just flew all over the country this weekend with some family issues that we had to take care of. And Let me tell you, I flew out of some airports that are very heavily secure. And you're right, William. It would be very difficult today to seize a plane on American soil.
Even if they got through our security net, three or four guys stand up in a plane.
Everybody's going to jump up. Everybody's going to jump up. Yep. Matter of fact, I was talking to producer Tom about a month ago when we were on a plane together. And I said, I want to give you a for instance. A guy gets up and is trying to get into the cockpit. Maybe he's nuts. Maybe he's a terrorist. Who knows? What do you do? He says, I'm going to get up and charge him. And you're going to be right behind me. And I said, I may be in front of you. And there will be others in front of us. I think every male on that plane is going to get up and go for it and try to stop that person.
I was on a flight. I think I even told you about this. I was on a flight a couple years ago, and gosh forbid that I profile. They were Middle Eastern. They were acting rather provocative. One of them did go up and started hassling the stewardess a little bit. I have stood up, made eye contact with the stewardess, but I looked back down the length of the plane, and there were two very military-looking guys in the seat directly behind where these two characters were sitting. Mm-hmm. We all made contact, and there was head nods.
Yep.
When the plane landed, these two provocative guys were gone. I talked with those military guys and said, hell yeah.
Absolutely. You have to. It's your responsibility now to do that.
Now, referencing back to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, ISIS looks at Al-Qaeda like, yeah, you guys did your thing, but we're a whole new generation of killers. They know our weaknesses. They know the stupidity of trying to go for a plane.
Well, Al-Qaeda was like the mob used to be in the 20s and 30s, where even though they commit mayhem and murder, they did it with quote-unquote dignity. They didn't do it in people's houses. They never attacked the wives or children. ISIS, on the other hand, is the new breed. They're like the cartel. They don't care who they hurt. They don't care who they kill because their aim is total control and disruption. And so if they go after your wife or your kid, they have no morality about that. There's no law of crime there with them.
You give me an analogy, I'll have to confess, I'll use interviews henceforth. That's a great analogy. The mob of the 20s versus the mob of today.
Yeah.
The mob of today, no, to bring you down, they will go directly at your child first. They will directly go at your wife. They'll directly go at your parents to break you. Whereas in the old Godfather movie, remember, it used to be, it's not personal, it's business. Bang.
That's right. You know, we'll cut your horse's head off. We'll put it in your bed. But we're not going to, you know, play around with your family and your friends and your kids.
Let's get grim. It will be your child's head because there's actual, I watched some video of, it was ghastly, a 10-year-old child. They were training him how to decapitate prisoners, and they were urging, we're talking about 10-year-old killers.
Is this all because of religion, William? Is that what they want? Do they want to convert everybody?
I got into reading the Quran, and we're going to maybe get a bit controversial on this. I was pulling up various surahs that ISIS itself was referencing, and number one surah that declares that, hey, you can do anything because Allah himself is the great deceiver. Secondly, numerous surahs, that surahs are like chapters in our Bible, and I don't like comparing the two books, but it was about infiltrate, ingratiate, if need be, even act like you've converted. But once you have the ability to gain control, either your opponent will convert by paying the tax and submit, or will die. ISIS has a dream, literally, of triggering a global jihad. That's not paranoia. That is their dream. There's a question about where are moderate Muslims on all this. Regarding you and me right now, we're dead men, as far as they're concerned.
Let's say 3 each hit schools or malls, and keep in mind, if you're listening, they're already thinking about this. We're not putting any thoughts into their head.
Please, thank you for saying that.
So they do it in a coordinated attack, 10 of them, 10 attacks all around the country at the same time. Police can't respond fast enough. We don't have military that you can put together fast enough. How long is it going to take before you get those 3 under control and get them arrested or shot?
Well, remember, they're on a one-way mission, because then they get
they're suicidal.
72 virgins, right. There is not even really time to react. Now, let me ask a question of you. The moment 9/11 starts to unravel, were you concerned about the security of your loved ones and family at that moment?
Short term, no. Not at that point. I was more concerned about, are there other things planned for the country, in the country, beyond just what we saw that day?
Second point to consider. On 9/11, think of the communications technology of 9/11. We did have cell phone, but remember, the cell phones overloaded in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon within a matter of minutes.
Right.
We're in a couple of generational leaps. Within a matter of seconds, everybody would be sending their selfies and their video of what is going on. Now, put those things together. Let's just say 5 schools get hit, as in the scenario I wrote about. And suddenly that's coming up on cell phones, but it's also coming up on the news. And, of course, the news helicopters are broadcasting this as well. Would there not be a national panic of every parent in America racing to the 98,000 public schools, even though only 5 are under attack? There would be a massive shutdown of this country within a matter of minutes.
To pull their kids out.
Pull their kids
now, out. And I'm going to say this. That's one reason I'm glad we have the Second Amendment, because every American who is out there in armed by the thousands are going to do what they have to do to fight this.
Let me point out that my book is only 46,000 words. It can be read in 3 hours, but the main character is a teacher who decides on that particular day he is breaking the law because of news stories that are making him anxious. So he walks into a school to teach for the day, and he's carrying. He is in violation of both federal and state law where this character lives. He would face 5 years in jail for doing that.
You cannot carry in that public school system.
There are some schools, districts, where folks are listening right now, in Texas, for example.
They'll let teachers do that.
They're training them. They're training them. Rather than a stupid education course, and you're talking about a professor who was stuck in those type of things, I would rather see 6 credit hours, every teacher, on self-defense and how to protect your children, and we have to rethink our school security completely.
Now, unfortunately, these terrorists are going to have assault weapons. Most Americans will have pistols or handguns, you know, revolvers.
Right. You know, I saw on Facebook, and I'm curious to know what your goal number is, but I imagine it's 7 figures on Facebook.
We're approaching, we will get there. We've got millions, as you know, listeners. Facebook, we've got about 300,000 dedicated people who follow us on Facebook.
Well, I'm going to pass the word out. I'm going to click that box after we're off the air and tell all my friends to do it. But somebody posted up on Facebook recently, very idealistically, a teacher who's developed a new kind of lock for a door. This will protect our classrooms. And this, my friend was waxing on, all schools need this. It's only $70 a door. I'm watching the ad, and I'm having a sick laugh because the person advertising this, right behind their back is a window. Oh, great. You lock the door, but you have somebody come up with an assault window, you know, an assault weapon. He'll just blow the window out with 2 or 3 shots and climb on
through. Of course, absolutely.
It's absurd.
Is there a reason for the terror? I mean, is it because we support Israel? What is it?
The fundamental reason? We're infidels. And by their teachings, the end time will finally come when we are dead. Come on, wake up, America. We are dead. There is no negotiating. Every time I'm out with Robin and we pull up behind a car that has that coexist bumper sticker, I want to go up and knock on the window of the driver and say, excuse me, if I'm an ISIS terrorist, do you think we could coexist? There's no coexistence with ISIS. This is the manifestation of Satan on Earth.
Who's behind it? Somebody's got to be the brains of this thing.
Let's look at the leader who calls himself now the Caliph. Not many people know he was an American POW for 4 years. We caught him in Iraq in 2005. We held that guy for 4 years. He now calls himself al-Baghdadi. That one sounds like a bad...
Right. And where's he hiding out at? Do we know?
We don't know. Assume somewhere in the Raqqa area. But we released him in 2009 along with thousands of others. And there was an interview with one of the guards that knew this guy, tried to reach to him in some way, and as this now leader of ISIS was walking out, he talked to the guard and said, I'll see you in New York.
He probably means that.
He definitely meant it, because the security team at that prison was a National Guard unit that was made up significant numbers of New York City policemen and firemen and law enforcement officers who had been at the World Trade Center. So these guys were highly sensitive to that issue. And these prisoners we were releasing were taunting these survivors of 9/11, saying, we're going to be in New York again someday. See you then.
Are we?
I take that serious.
Are we bombing now because we know something about what could happen here?
What effect is tactical action having at this moment? I saw the figure the other day where we've, up to that point, we've done 146 airstrikes. We're putting a $30 to $40, $50 million aircraft in the air, maybe $100,000 an hour to drop a bomb on an SUV. And yet we saw parades, and there's video out there of them triumphantly parading captured M1 tanks, Bradleys, Stryker vehicle. Yeah. They seized 25 aircraft from the Syrian Air Force. Do we really think that these pinpoint tactical strikes are going to stop this organization? It ain't going to work that way.
So where's it all headed?
It's headed to a cataclysmic war unless we wake up and proactively strike back hard, very, very hard.
Nukes?
Don't take that off the table.
I wouldn't. I wouldn't take it off the table.
Well, we did last week, did we not?
You can't. You have to, as tragic as it is, you have to be able to show incredible force. If you have a cluster of 10,000 of them in a mountain, I would level the mountain.
Analogy. Jack Kennedy, October 1962.
Hold on for a second. We'll get right into that when we come back.